is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Welcome to the Weekend News Magazine, Viewpoint This Sunday. Now, this is Malcolm Out Loud. Well, I think the big story in the nation this week is executive privilege is out, but white privilege is in. So there you go, in a capsule, huh? Well, the case that is riveting the nation, probably the world at this point, I can see somebody in a room down in South Africa watching this trial as well somewhere, right, is the Rittenhouse trial. You know, the question people are asking on this is this a patriot taking a stand against lawlessness or a vigilante gone wild, I guess is the question people are putting out. There's a lot more questions as well. What makes this case so interesting is that the decision was made that Rittenhouse was going to be on the stand, and then you heard from, you know, the person himself, which normally that's not the case. It was a very risky moment to put him on there, many people believe. But again, is it compelling enough to get people to see his emotions and everything that is happening? You know, U.S. News and World Report says while Rittenhouse is white, as were those he shot, the case has stirred racially fraught debate over vigilantism, the right to bear arms, and the unrest that erupted around the U.S. Over the summer, police violence against black people. So here you go. You've got this guy. He's a white guy. The three people that he shot were also white. And, you know, it's remarkable in our country that we can pull racism, black and white, out of a crime that is all white people. That in itself is a magic trick. That's remarkable for sure. Now, you know, this one piece I got to share with you here in The Guardian, Moira Donegan, the headline, Kyle Rittenhouse isn't crying for those he hurt. His tears tellingly are for himself. And listen to this excerpt here. When conservative men like Rittenhouse and Brett Kavanaugh, now we're going to go there, right, and compare him to that, express their feelings, it is an act of thwarted entitlement or threat. It was a performance meant to make him seem helpless and childlike and to convince the jury in his homicide trial that there was a reasonable possibility that he was in fear for his life when he shot the three men. But to many, the emotion of Rittenhouse testimony seemed to stem not from his memories of the incident, but from the indignant entitlement of a white man thwarted in the enforcement of his own privilege. Wow, wow, wow. So the comparison of the tears in the Rittenhouse trial are now being compared to Brett Kavanaugh, and racism is all over this trial, of course. And, you know, of course, you remember with Kavanaugh, with Christine Blasey Ford, and of course, totally different circumstances. And in that case, Kavanaugh shortly was got the raw end of that stick. But the sense of the emotion is what they're speaking about here. And there's some interesting commentary out there you see in the country, which I think everybody should pay attention to. This one goes on to say, but they both also pointed to a peculiar phenomenon that remains little understood, the right-wing use of public displays of white male emotionalism as a political tool. Wow. I mean, it's remarkable how now we're going there. And let me also share with you Vox's Jamil Smith says, she puts it this way. We're generally unfamiliar with seeing boys and men exhibit their emotion in such a public way. Vulnerability and common conceptions of manhood, especially among conservatives, have not traditionally been bedfellows. That gives you an idea of what's happening right there. So that case, we'll know more in the next week or so what happens with Rittenhouse. We'll talk more about that today. The other big story is Steve Bannon that's also under great scrutiny. And he has been indicted by Congress. And now this is something that normally doesn't happen. And this is kind of interesting because you got Mark Meadows also on Friday that he refused to appear for deposition and being subpoenaed, of course. And now the department says they're going to go after him for criminal prosecution. Very interesting. Attorney General Merrick Garland's press release, listen to this, says this. Since my first day in office, I have promised Justice Department employees that together we would show the American people by word and deed that the department adheres to the rule of law, follows the facts and the law, and pursues equal justice under the law. Today's charges reflect the department's steadfast commitment to these principles. Well, yeah, that's true, Attorney General, as long as it's not the John Durham of the Russia probe or Hillary Clinton's email said, that would be an accurate statement. But clearly justice is one-sided in this country, people, and you just got to get a joke as you choke off of that response from that press release there. Now, this gets into the whole January 6th commission. Of course, Liz Cheney's up at the top of that, so you get a sense of what's happening there. And you also got the fact that you're seeing a lot of the reports, too, with Donald Trump and that he's trying to have executive privilege with the records. Very, very interesting. It's a slippery, slippery slope here. We're going to start right at the top of the program here, my friends, and talk about the supply chain first here and what a story this is here. We'll do it with J.D. Rucker is here. He's a journalist, an activist fighting for Christian conservative values. You'll catch his work on the NOC report, the NOQ report, and Liberty Daily. And J.D., the supply chain first. All right, so Jonathan Gold, Vice President of Supply Chain Policy at the National Retail Federation, says at this point, shortages are guaranteed. We've been warning consumers to manage their expectations for the holiday shopping season for months now. Fact of the matter is the supply chain is stretched to its limits from end to end. Let's get to the core of this conversation. There's a lot of talk out there about the supply chain. And of course, the Biden administration isn't doing enough or doing nothing about the supply chain problem. What do you see as the core of this? I mean, you're out on the West Coast. And how bad is it there, by the way?
It's getting bad. You know, I don't think we have it as bad as a lot of folks out there, but it is starting to get bad. You know, the main concern, I know they're talking about Christmas. Look, the main concern needs to be food. It needs to be fuel. It needs to be the things that people need to survive. So I'm not so much interested in whether or not, you know, forgive me for not knowing what toys are available, but whether or not Pokemon or Xbox, you know, get under Christmas trees in time. I know that's important stuff, but look, I want to make sure that people have food. I want to make sure they have water. I want to make sure they have all the supplies they need. Yeah. And right now that's all in question. You ask what the core is. That's kind of a challenging question because people seem to associate the supply chain with dominoes because that's really, you know, our supply chain is associated with, you know, you start from point A, you get to point B, C, D, and then eventually that's how, you know, there's a process for how something goes from a cow to ground beef in your freezer, right? Mm-hmm. So we always think of it like along a line, but this supply chain issue is really, it's radiating. In other words, every little itty bitty issue grows into a bigger issue and causes other issues, you know, in both directions. You know, whether you're causing a bottleneck or you're causing, challenges down the line, there's going to be something bad that comes from whether it's the truckers, this current shortage of truckers, the over 100 ships sitting out in the bay outside of Los Angeles, whether it's people that just aren't working, aren't incentivized to work, and for whatever reason, aren't trying to get out there to work. We could name a dozen different issues, but you know, what is the core? Right. You asked, is the Biden-Harris regime, are they doing enough? Mm-hmm. No, they're actually doing whatever they can at this point to exacerbate the situation. And this is how we know that it's intentional. That's the scary part, Malcolm.
Wow. Well, you know, you bring up a point right there. So, all right, let's just imagine, and everybody can imagine what I'm going to say next to JD. So let's say Trump was an officer. This happened during the Trump administration. I mean, can you imagine this sort of a setup with a Donald Trump in office? I mean, I would imagine he would have brought some people right over to the ports and started unloading those things himself, probably. In other words, he'd be very hands-on on something like this, which is supply chain economics. And you're right. There are a lot of factors that cause this. It's not just one thing, probably. But, you know, I'll tell you what else. If we weren't so reliant on China for all of our knickknacks and polywax, give a dog a bone, we wouldn't probably even be in this position. But we certainly are connected at the hip with them and all this kind of, as you say, trinkets of stuff of the holidays. But it really isn't that the case, though, with Trump, that, I mean, it really is how you handle it at the executive level and how important it is to shake the system up. And I don't see Biden and Kamala Harris doing that.
No, not at all. You know, if I had one, I've always had two complaints about President Trump. Number one, I thought that he picked the wrong people sometimes. Okay. Don't give me the, you know, look at H.R. McMaster, Reince Priebus, all these people. Sometimes, especially in the beginning, he didn't pick the right people. No big deal. Yeah, okay. You know, he eventually started getting around to the good people by the end. Okay. But the other one is that he would sometimes do too much. In other words, he was a man of action. He wasn't a hands-off person. And as a conservative, I would prefer people stay hands-off. Here's the thing. At situations like this that we're in today, mm-hmm. you got to have somebody that's hands-on. You can't have somebody who's out there like Joe Biden who doesn't even know where his hands are, let alone what to do with them. Trump would have been ideal to be able to handle the situation, because you're right. He would have been able to go out there and say, look, they're suffering. Let's oversimplify this and say there's ships out there with stuff that we need. What do we need to do as the United States of America? What do I need to do as the president to get that stuff off the ships?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And sometimes that makes all the difference in the world here. Now, experts are predicting these disruptions, by the way, friends, will continue well into 2023, is what they're saying. So this is not going to be evidently a short-lived problem for whatever it is. But it is complicated, JD, as you say. There are so many factors that fall into it. We mentioned China right there, but there are a lot of other factors with jobs, the economics, the inflation. All these things are really having a sandwich effect. And the way they're handling the economy and with inflation on the rise, this is going to be a big problem ahead here. Now, let's talk about Steve Bannon. This was a double take when I seen this come over the wire on Friday. I said, wow, because Congress almost never does this. They never exercise this contempt of Congress. It almost hardly ever is exercised in the way that it was here. So the Justice Department obtained the grand jury indictment against Steve Bannon, the former Trump advisor, of course, on two counts of contempt of Congress for failing to comply with the subpoenas from the House Select Committee on the January 6th event there. Again, very, very rare that this ever happens. There's a couple of interesting takes on this thing that I do find interesting. But let me read you this from the committee there Benny Thompson is the chair and Liz Cheney is the vice chair, as you know, here. Steve Bannon's indictment should send a clear message to anyone who thinks they can ignore this select committee or try to stonewall our investigation. No one is above the law. We will not hesitate to use the tools at our disposal to get the information we need. Where are they going with this? Because now Mark Meadows is right in line, and there's a whole host of others. I mean, I think they put about about 16 subpoenas out there to a lot of the heads in the Trump. And, of course, executive privilege seems to be out the door. Where are they going with all this, you think? What's your take?
I mean, they're trying to nail people with something that it's almost like, you know, they couldn't get them on the actual crime, so they're going to try to basically manufacture a crime. I guess you could say they're trying to pull an Al Capone. They couldn't get Capone on the bad things he did, so they tried to, let's get him in jail for tax evasion. You can't figure out, they can't pin January 6th on any of these people, you know, whether Trump or on down. They can't do it. There's nothing there. And even if they could, all they'd be doing is exposing what actually happened on January 6th, which, as we're learning increasingly clearly every single day, was, you know, manufactured. It was deep state. It was Antifa. It was whoever you want to say. You could even make a case that Nancy Pelosi played a role in making sure that January 6th happened the way that it did. So they can't actually get Trump or any of his people on the events of January 6th. So they're trying to figure, okay, well, yeah, but contempt of Congress. Ooh, you know, this is the big one. You mentioned executive privilege, and I guess that's out the door. We're going to see, and this is where this comes into play, because, you know, it's funny because I'm glad that they picked Bannon. They picked Bannon because he was their quote unquote easy target. He's the one that represents everything that's bad about Trump world, you know, in the eyes of the left, but he's all the right person to be fighting this battle. Let's see, he's going to go to court. He's going to face a judge. His team is going to say, look, you know, we have executive privilege. I was in the White House, yada, yada, yada. It's already been evoked. You know, this is all bull. And he's going to try to throw out all the evidence that he can. And we'll see if it sticks. If he has to go to jail, you know, for a month and pay $1,000 fine, okay, well, that sucks. But I'm glad that it's him and not, like you said, Mark Meadows or any of the other people. He's the one that you want testing this.
That's a good point you bring up. It's a very good point because of his chutzpah and where he's at, you're exactly right. And I would guess he probably would do the month in jail. I mean, you know, it's kind of strange sometimes, JD, as far as I can see, when these sort of things happen like this, and you become the pitcher of that story, you're actually, in a weird sort of way, your star can rise, certainly within those circles. And I think...
Well, I'm sorry, for him, for sure. This would be very beneficial to his career. I'm sorry.
I think you're right on. Perfect. I think it would. And I think that I don't see like him, this hurting him in any other way other than, okay, you spend a month there or whatever, like you say, the hell it is, and you pay a small fine, what have you. But you held up a position. He'd become more of an icon in those circles to say he went against the system. You know, the whole thing about January 6th is very disturbing to so many Americans because of the setup on this thing. You know, what actually surprises me, JD, and I don't know if you know think about this in the same terms I did or if you have an answer for it, but one of the things that surprises me is the whole setup on January 6th smelt really bad. I mean, everybody knows the way they were being waved in, the way the security was called off, the way the police were not there, the way Pelosi's involvement was. And there were a lot of things that smelt very, very fishy about January 6th, even leading up to that event. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that suggests there's another storyline here that still hasn't been exposed in any circles that I'm really seeing. And I kind of, when they started to go down this with the commission and they put this all together, I was actually surprised, actually, that they got behind it, the left and Pelosi and all, because I thought they would be taking a gamble. Correct me on this, or I thought maybe they would be taking this gamble that something else would surface with this, because I'm convinced there's another storyline here. What do you think?
So yes and yes. And then there's a big no. Yes, it was a gamble in their eyes. Yes, they knew exactly what could happen, but no, they have no fear. This is it's funny. I don't even want to call it the Democrat playbook or the radical leftist playbook anymore. I'm going to call it the powers that be playbook. This is what they do. Okay. Think back to 2019, you know, you got Joe Biden sitting there. It's like, hey, you know, we heard, got to get word to you, you know, whether I guess it would be H.R. McMaster and I forget the guy's name now, the one that you could never say his name or get banned on Facebook. Ciaramelli, I think it was. You know, you have him saying, hey, you know, Joe, guess what? Looks like the Trump's going after you in Ukraine. You know, they're talking about looking into you and your involvement with, you know, bribing and corruption and all this stuff and getting Shokin fired. So the Democrats react with, well, let's, instead of, you know, risking that, let's go after Trump and let's project the crime that he's going to be accusing Joe Biden of. Let's project that crime on him. Let's say that he's the one who's going after Ukraine. Let's say he's the one that's doing this, that, or the other. They know, Malcolm, that they did very wrong on January 6th. So instead of trying to hide that with, oh, nothing to see here, which they used to do. Now it's more like, well, let's get really loud. Let's get our mainstream media buddies involved. Let's get everybody involved. And let's say, no, January 6th was a conspiracy. And it was, it wasn't Pelosi. Let's see, who do we want to go? It was Bannon, you know, and it wasn't Muriel Bowser, the mayor of DC. It was Mark Meadows. Yeah. Throw him in there.
Yeah, the plan, what you're talking about is really something interesting to me because, you know, I think you're right with what you say. And they do this in all walks of life. They do it about with every political argument in a brilliant way. The left is brilliant at what you just suggest. And in this particular case, you almost think, wow. But you know what, JD, they are brazen enough actually to do what you suggest. And it doesn't really surprise me. I'm really curious as well. I assume as we move down the road here, actually, history will begin to show something else about the whole January 6th event, I believe. You know, maybe it comes out, you know, when some of these people are gone and we moved on to the next generation. But again, there's a whole another storyline here. And the other real fast thing I want to ask you about, JD, on this, and I want to get over to Rittenhouse here, is the judge saying that Trump can't block the January 6th committee's access to the records. Presidents are not kings, he says. And of course, the current administration is denying all the executive privileges across the board for everybody, including Mark Meadows, including Bannon, but surely including Trump and anything associated with him. And he goes on with a whole dissertation about presidents not being kings and whatever, et cetera. What's your gut feeling? What's in all of those records that Trump is? Does that send the right message to the country? I'm asking you straight out that he's trying to block all that from coming out.
You know, you never know with Trump. You never know with Trump in both directions. In other words, like, you don't know what motivates him to do things, and you don't know what motivates his enemies to try to do things. Okay, yeah. You know, we look at the tax returns for years. Okay, people were saying, oh, you know, the tax returns must have something just horrific. He's trying so hard. And he really was. He was trying so hard to make sure the tax returns never get out. You know, he said he was going to do it during the campaign and he never did. Then he said he was going to do it during presidency and he never did. So we're going to file lawsuits and lawsuits and lawsuits. We're going to, you know, sneak people around. And then, you know, when the tax returns, at least portions of them, finally came out, it was just a big nothing burger. Mm. You know, he fought tooth and nail to make sure that people didn't know that basically there's a little bit of oddity in his taxes. It wasn't that big of a deal. He just showed he didn't have as much money as a lot of people thought he did. So I don't know what kind of information is in the January 6th documents. All I know is that whether it's big or a big deal, or I don't think there's going to be anything there that could implicate him or anyone else in a crime.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you're right when you talk about that. I think everybody can take something away from what you say there, because you never really know how Trump is playing the game. And that is accurate. However, there is this node in this mode in the country about transparency and the lack of it. And the fact is, he's been encouraged many times, even when he was in the White House, to open up the doors and get these records out there in so many different ways. And I just wonder if this puts any sort of a light on things in some way. I wish in some ways he'd open it right up and throw it out there and say, okay, go have had it. All right. Speaking about privilege, let's get over now to the new game in town, JD, and that's white privilege. And this is remarkable here. So on Rittenhouse now. So I ask up front, is this a patriot taking a stand against lawlessness or a vigilante gone wild? This story is unbelievable, what's happening with Rittenhouse. I mean, they're all white, the three people he shoot, the one he's not. And all the stories I'm reading, they've still got this whole thing surrounded about racism. Trial, very emotional. The kids put on, of course, he was 17 years old when he did this, you know, carrying the assault rifle through town and blah, blah, blah. And what do you think about the prosecutor and how arrogant he's been? Is he, everybody's thinking he really wants a mistrial, first of all. Do you think he wants a mistrial?
I think he wants to escape and find himself a Snickers bar, because he's just, I mean, he's been an absolute embarrassment to his trade, to his family. I mean, his ancestors are feeling the shame of how bad he's doing. Mistrial would be good for him now. This should be a slam dunk. Okay. It really should be. And the prosecutor should be just terrified out of his mind. Instead, he's pushing forward, and they push forward. They're going with, you know, basically an image that's a lie. It's been demonstrated to be a lie, mm-hmm. that, you know, the hand and yada, yada, yada. I don't know what they hope for, but in a sane world, I would say there's a 90% chance, 95% chance that he gets acquitted. I'm at about 50-50 right now, brother. And that's terrifying considering what we know. Look, Kyle Rittenhouse, people will say what they want about, oh, he was 17. You know, why did he have an AR-15? Why was he there in the first place? America today needs more people like Kyle Rittenhouse. We do. We need people like that. I'm not saying, you know, with AR-15s at 17 going out in vigilante justice. I'm saying people who are willing to stand up and do something. What is it that they can do to help? And what is it that they can do to fix things instead of going to Twitter and just, oh, you know, things are bad. This sucks. You know, yada, 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 or hitting Netflix or doing nothing.
Yeah,
I think I'm not going to go so far as say Kyle Rittenhouse is like he's an American hero. No, he's a kid that got caught in a really weird situation. He did what he needed to do to defend himself. I don't blame him for that. Should he have been there? You know, probably. Mm. because somebody has to be there. Somebody has to stand up. Sorry, I'm ranting. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's exactly it. There's a lot of questions, even to the point of what you just say. Should he have been there? The prosecutor's trying that line as well, clearly saying he should have never been involved in this thing to begin with. And then the other image you say of a 17-year-old with a rifle walking through town. I mean, is this where we're at in our country? But, you know, at the same time, let me just say, JD, you know, we've watched the images around our country. This is a tough deal. I mean, any reasonable person doesn't really want to see anybody get shot and killed in these sort of circumstances. But we've seen our cities, I mean, so many of them from sea to sea here, that have been just totally, I mean, destroyed, and people killed and injured and injuries, all that sort of thing, but also totally destroyed economically. And that's okay with the left in this country. In fact, they're the ones who push all of this agenda. And now with this here, and now we've got this kid who stands up against all this, it's kind of interesting in a kind of way. I see it almost like a Tiananmen Square moment, you know, where the tank is there and this kid, 17, is out there. Was it the right thing to put him? Should he have been on the stand there? Will that come back as a good thing, or will it come back to haunt him? Obviously, he's been very emotional, very breaking down, which, of course, they make in front of that as well as they did Kavanaugh, by the way. But was this a good thing?
The answer to your question will be determined by the verdict. You know, if he's found guilty, then it was a bad move to put him on the stand. And if he wasn't, if he's acquitted, then, oh, you know, brilliant move to put him on the stand. I'm glad that he was on the stand, because it does give us, it gives America an image. And whether LeBron James wants to go and say that he was fake crying, or people want to say, oh, you fell for it, or you've got other people on our side that are like, oh my gosh, you know, why is this kid not being served tomato soup and a grilled cheese sandwich at home right now? You know, I mean, people will have a lasting image of Kyle Rittenhouse, no matter how his story continues. I don't want to say ends, because I hope his story doesn't end here, but no matter where his story goes from here, we're going to have that lasting image of him breaking down on the stand. And that's a good thing, I think, because we need to be able to see who this person is from an emotional perspective versus just the kid standing there with an AR-15.
Ian, and you believe at the end of the day, I think you really said your feelings on this are about 50-50, yeah?
Yeah. If we're okay, 60-40, I think he's going to get acquitted. I know a lot of people were scared because it was a really bad day for the defense, you know, the last day. But I think that at the end of the day, they still have demonstrated, you know, it's not like you said, it would be completely different if the scenarios were bad. If it wasn't, you know, let's say that he didn't shoot a white pedophile. Okay. Yeah. Then if he shot a female person of color who was, you know, just a non-criminal, you know, somebody without an offense, I think he'd be toast.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
the fact that he did, I mean, he kind of drew the lucky card today instead of, it's funny because he drew the lucky card of, hey, yeah, so he shot, you know, white men. But even then, you know, this is how the race baiters work. No matter what, you know, pick exactly a card, any card. Like you said, it's a magic trick. They'll always pick the race card every time.
Every time, yeah. Boy, you pick up so well on these details, and you're so right with what you say there. He did pull a lucky card, believe it or not, and have the circumstances been differently, just by fate, JD, you're right. He'd have been totally toast before you even started. If this really was a black-white thing, and not just hypothetically or in some conspiratorial mode that these people put together, it would be all about over, because this country we're just lit for all of that. It's people are just fuming. JD, thank you for joining me at the top of the program here with all these stories. A lot more to talk about on all these stories, but they're fascinating as hell, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me on, Malcolm.
I want to take a look now and look at when we talk about a bigger danger, many believe, to our nation, and that is China. Is China the threat that many people believe it is? We are going to take that up next with Dr. Lee Meng-Yung, and Wallace Garneau will join us. Fascinating piece to talk about, too, The Reckoning. We'll see you on the other side of the pause here. You're listening to Viewpoint this Sunday.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
You know, Healthy Cell is a terrific lineup of products. They have products that are pill-free, gel-pack vitamins. Looking for better sleep, focus, and energy? Check out Healthy Cell, the leading innovator in nutritional supplements for cell health. Healthy Cell has a product that helps REM sleep, helps you fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM Sleep Supplement. The only sleep supplement that's designed to support all stages of sleep. And boy, is it needed now during all the stress of the COVID-19 pandemic. So go to healthycell.com and use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, OUTLOUD, for a 20% off your first order of any product from Healthy Cell. I use them every day. I believe in them, and you should too. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
AmericaOutloud.com is the alternative from the agenda-driven globalist. Here, we take on the challenges of our generation so that we can preserve future generations. On-demand podcast or real-time talk radio with our streaming apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all. Welcome back to Viewpoint this Sunday. It is Malcolm Out Loud here, yours truly. Thank you, as always, my friends, for being with me on this mission. And I want to dive into China now a bit here. You see some of these recent stories, if you've been paying attention, that is, with the hypersonic missile, which really was a game changer. And, you know, you see a lot of the headlines around that suggest, well, our intelligence world was in shock here, and our political leaders were in shock. And I guess the question I put back to you is, were they in shock, do you think? I know the media stories were saying that, but really, were they in shock, or did they have any indication how far down the road China was in development of this hypersonic missile? And the fact of the matter is, it is a game changer, people. Just as Russia is pursuing that and has been testing them as well, it is a game changer for a lot of reasons. Dr. Li Mengyong is here. She's an independent virologist, whistleblower on the CCP. The thing I like about Dr. Li Mengyong is she has an inside perspective. Now, having lived there all her life and just really being in the States here a short time here, she has a different perspective than most people. You know, you can get on just any analyst and they can speak about it hypothetically, but not in real world terms of understanding how they think, what they are. That's what I find fascinating about her. Joining us as well, Wallace Garneau is here. Wallace spent 23 years e-commerce manager, IT manager, and he's a political analyst, a terrific writer, one of these guys that makes you think. And one of his pieces I'll be referencing here in just moments is called The Reckoning. And I think it's a brilliant read because, it's one of those pieces that you look at all sides of the debate and it makes you think just a bit here. Let's start off with the supply chain specifically, because we were referencing that up front of the program here. Wallace, let me go with you first on the supply chain business. You know, they're now predicting that this thing is going to stretch out into 2023. No short-term answers. Inflation is rising. The economy is in trouble. But this story, to me, comes back to the fact that we wouldn't be in this position, which is one of the things that Donald Trump was trying to address, if it wasn't for our dependency on a lot of and our relationship with China. Now, we wouldn't be in this position very much with the ports and all of that. But a lot of this stuff we don't make here anymore. We rely on China, basically. And that's kind of we've known this was going to happen. In fact, it happened through the pandemic with medications and antibiotics they threatened to hold back and things of that nature. That is a real danger of this relationship with China. And it looks like Biden has reversed all of these policies. So what's your take on the supply chain problem? In different areas of the country, they are paying a big price for this right now. And again, I harp back to China being at the core of some of this. Of course, there's a lot of other problems, work, economy, our jobs, the truckers. But what's your take on it?
Yeah, I'm a free market guy, so I'm a little bit torn on that subject. On the one hand, we do want to trade freely with other nations, but to trade freely with us. On the other hand, China has never been a very good trading partner for us. China has never traded freely. They've always been very, very protectionist. They've played dirty games trying to shut down our industry so they could sweep in and take them over. They buy our industries. They're not a good trading partner. They're not a fair player. And yes, we were overly reliant on a company that we knew was a bad actor. We did that obviously because their labor was cheaper. I mean, you think over the course of your life, think about how much more expensive a refrigerator would be if they were made here. American labor was going into building them. You know, you're paying somebody now maybe $12, $15, today probably $20 an hour to build a refrigerator. Now, the reason why these things are disposable in our country and have been for most of your my life, the reason why when a refrigerator breaks, you don't repair it the way you do a car, is because American labor has always been so expensive, or has been so expensive for the last, call it 40 years, that it's cheaper to get a new one than it is to have somebody come out and fix it. And in some ways, it's a good thing. In some ways, it's a bad thing. But certainly our over-reliance on unfair trading partners and unreliable trading partners that are bad players and that are actively enemies of the United States is an issue. We were stupid to get involved in the first place. Going all the way back to Nixon, we have completely misplayed this card, and now we're paying the piper for it. But it's not just China. It's also the fact that none of our ports are operating above 70% efficiency. It's that our truckers are, we got rid of a lot of truckers during the pandemic. We haven't brought them back. So even if the ports could unload at 100% efficiency, we can't remove product from the ports at 100% efficiency. There are a lot of problems here that are driven primarily by the pandemic, but also by an over-reliance on China and probably other unfair trading partners as well.
The other big thing here, and Dr. Li Mengyang, I want to go right to you now and talk to you about the origins of this other big story in COVID-19. In a very interesting piece that Wallace has up called The Reckoning, and I'm anxious to get your take on it. You know, he puts it out there, says COVID-19 is being used to weaken Western economies. That COVID-19 was the impetus. And there were a lot of, we talked about this over the past couple of years, actually. The only GDP that was positive or that rose was China's. Everybody else had a decline in the world. And yet they were on the other side of that. This COVID-19, do you think the origins of this from China, was that part of the CCP game plan to weaken Western economies? Was that part of it?
Oh, yes, Malcolm. Actually, I totally agree with Wallace. And I think we have talked about this point before, because China government knows that there is big difference between China and America. The economic difference is one of that. And how to drag America down? So this is what they can use the COVID-19 to achieve. And during the COVID-19, they make this kind of chaos. And also plus the misinformation. All the things make Americans get into a lot of messed up situation. So your medical system get broke down, and also you have to lock down, and you cannot go to work, and you cannot do anything normally. So your economic goes down. And for China, that's why they use such unrestricted bioweapons. Before you realize what happened, they already start to achieve their goals.
Do you have any idea at all as to how many people have, do you have a guess or or have you looked at how many people have died from COVID-19 in China? Any idea?
We don't know. We would never know that, because, for example, from the beginning of COVID-19, China government used thousands of ways to cover up the death number, and you really have no way, even Chinese government, I don't think they have their way to understand how many people are dead. And actually, they really don't care about that.
You know, when we started talking about it back in early 2020 and actually end of 2019, because we were talking about it before it was even here in the States, on our platform, because we knew the story was happening out there in Wuhan. I remember us talking about the crematoriums that were burning, and there was actually a problem there with breathing because there were so many people dying from it, and it was really hyped up. You know, when you look at this bioweapon and that was unleashed onto the world, Dr. Li Mengyang, and you look at it in that way, talk to me about the value of human life a moment. How does, and this is, I mean, may not sound right, but it's a serious question. How does the CCP, how does China look at, I mean, is there any value for human life there in your opinion at all?
No, there is no any mercy of human life from Chinese Communist Party. This regime is totally evil. So based on their Marxism, communism ideology, they treat humans just as tools. And because in China, we have 1.4 million humans, that means their tools cost even cheaper. That's what they feel. And they can't do anything. They can't do anything just because they will not think about human life. So they will use humans to launch some wars, like at that time in the North Korea, just send tens of thousands of people to the North Korea, let them die there. And also they can do cultural revolution, and they can also do the big stuff. All this kind of action, all the wars, people just die. Thousands of people die. China government even didn't say anything regretful. However, in our history, they even tried to label it as the great thing done by the Chinese Communist Party. So they totally twisted the history, and their value is totally opposite to the Western civilization.
You know, Xi Jinping, I want to ask you 2 points here, Dr. Yan. Have we underestimated, has the West, and surely the U.S., have we underestimated Xi Jinping? I seen a story the other day about Xi, and that, of course, he's, you know, emperor for life there or whatever, and that they were, some reports say that they're actually happy with his work and they're giving him a pat on the back. Others say he could be in jeopardy. But, you know, he's a very unassuming fellow when you see him, very soft-spoken, low-key. Have we underestimated what they're capable of? And let me, that's part one. But the second part to this I want to ask you is, and this is important, knowing everything you know about the CCP and this China government, do you think, we talked about the hypersonic missile and all of that, which is a first strike capability, because it's, you can't detect these things if you put any nuclear arsenal on them or anything like that. Do you, in your mind, would China use something like that first? Would they take a chance? A lot of experts are split on this. I've talked to many people, would they exercise that in a first strike capability as an aggressor in your mind, or is that off the table from what you understand?
For the first question, I think Xi Jinping is psychopath. So I actually don't quite know how the Western government treats Xi Jinping. They may thought he's a gentleman, or they may thought he's still a normal person. No, what he has done already shows that he has no any normal human sense kind of feeling, and he may be insecure inside because he knows that in Chinese Communist Party system, everyone finally, if they lose the political fighting, can be pulled down, and then they will have very bad consequences. So for Xi Jinping, he tried his best to centralize his power. And the thing shows that after almost 10 years work, his power got great centralized. Now his ambition actually is more and more clear. He wants to make America into China. That was his idea, and that was his working on. So if you give more time to Xi Jinping and all you give more time to Chinese Communist Party, that means you are raising up your enemy and you are giving them chance to kill your people and to finally get your country. Mm. And for the other question, right. You want to know that whether this kind of high technology weapon can be the primary choice for Chinese government, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one thing when companies build these arsenals in defense, but would they ever go to that point to, I mean, because we're talking, that's a game changer that changes the world and puts the entire earth at risk. Would they do that? I'm asking you straight out.
Yes, actually, I don't think that will be their primary choice because from Chinese government's biosecurity that theory they established, they already explained that all this kind of like the nuclear weapon or other advanced weapon is just used to intimidate their enemies. I mean, primary enemy is America, you know. However, the main thing they are developing and they know they definitely get advantage is bioweapons. So this kind of trophy from the COVID pandemic, of course, gives them more confidence. And also, as I know that from their recent national plan, they already established the new targets that they will use donate more money and effort to develop the novel bioweapon, and they encourage the biotechnology. They want put money all over the world and to buy to craft more biologists, scientists, all like this. So Chinese government won't use this kind of hypersonic missile or other things easily. However, they will keep using the unrestricted bioweapon to undermine America and the other countries.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Wow. That is well said. Well said, Wallace. The future in these kinds of war is, as we've been talking about, is probably bioweapons. We know they've been doing this in their labs and looking at other opportunities. Cyber threats are very much at the top of that as well, and that's been something they've been very good at. This and AI is another component that's coming down the road here. It looks like the future of warfare is probably there, but again, with backs to the wall, the question is, and you wrote about this in your piece, The Reckoning, would they use it? Would probably be a last attempt sort of strategy, would it not?
Well, I think when we look at the difference between bioweapons and nuclear, I think clearly bioweapons, information warfare, and as you said, new forms of AI are their primary means of attack. And they've been very open about that. They've been very, very open about that. At the same time, they told Japan that if when they invade Taiwan, if Japan does so much as put one soldier on one ship and send it in the direction of Taiwan, they will not hesitate to do a full nuclear broadside and kill every human being in Japan on the entire Japanese home islands. So they have indicated a willingness to use nuclear weapons. And I think when somebody says, I'm willing to destroy an entire nation and kill everything in it, I think you have to take them at their word. That may be something that they would possibly do. And I think we also have to look at the tactical differences between a nuclear weapon and a bioweapon such as COVID-19 or another disease like that. A bioweapon is something that you don't really have a lot of control over once you put it out in the wild. You put it out in the wild, then it spreads and it does its thing, and you don't really have control over it. China, for example, with COVID-19, it started in Wuhan, China. They started in their own country, and it killed, now we don't know how many millions of their own people, mm-hmm. but it killed a lot of Chinese people before it escaped. And that appears to have been their goal, because of course, they shut down travel between Wuhan and the rest of China while leaving it open between Wuhan and the rest of the world until, ironically, the day after they had independent confirmation that it was in the wild in the United States. So that appears to be targeted. That is what I would call a smoking gun. But it's very tactically different than nuclear weapons. If you could have a first strike nuclear capability and you could completely disable your primary opponent all at once, take out their nuclear response, take out their command centers, take out some of their big cities, and just bring them to their knees. I don't know if you've ever seen the TV show Jericho, but it would be some, if you could do that to the United States. And then in Jericho, they even had the Chinese flying over and dropping food off. Now, that's, of course, a fictional television show. But if you could reduce the United States to that and then come in as the great savior and try to save the United States but turn us into a communist nation, you know, that's... I don't think it's either or. I think that strategically and tactically, if you have that first strike capability, it's just a very, very different kind of weapon for a very, very different kind of tactical scenario. It's more directed, it's more targeted, it's more controlled. And if we don't have the response, the ability to respond in kind, then you don't even lose your own people. You just kill, you know, hundreds of millions of Americans or whatever that number would be.
Yeah, yeah, very interesting. And I can't push back on anything you say there, because they could absolutely, like say, get back to their against the wall and potentially use any of these things here. I guess the bigger point of all of this is how do we handle the relationship with China moving forward? Right now, the Biden administration is faltering in foreign policy very clearly, and their relationship with China is very tainted to begin with as well. So when we talk about right now, I'm thinking about Taiwan, for instance. There are a lot of reports. I've talked to many military folks who believe there's going to be, they do believe there will be a strike on Taiwan after the Olympics. So it looks to me, and I want to get your opinion first, Wallace, and then Dr. Lee Meng-Young. And it looks to me like with the Biden administration in there right now, knowing how weak they are in everything, both internally and foreign policy, this would be the time to strike right now. And I would imagine China knows this. So I'm thinking that our most difficult chapter here is probably going to be after the Olympics, between there and probably either our midterm or surely before then and the end of the Biden administration, because they know they have a window right now while his administration is in office. What do you say to that, Wallace?
I say that there are 2 months of the year where the wind patterns, or the weather patterns rather, and the tidal patterns and everything line up for an invasion of Taiwan. And that if they were going to invade Taiwan, it would have to center around those two time windows every year. It's October and April. And I think that April would line up very nicely for China to attack Taiwan. The interesting thing there is Taiwan is not not completely indefensible. They have some very strong defensive capabilities. It is not a foregone conclusion that China. See, the thing is, we look at the size of the Chinese military and we think, okay, they've got a big military. They can push people around. To a certain degree, they can. But projecting power within your country is very, very different than projecting power outside of your country. Mm. Now, what they're relying on with Biden is the American Navy sitting on the fence, and then they've got a large enough Navy that then they can cross the Straits of Taiwan and invade Taiwan. If we're in the picture, what are they going to swim? I mean, there's no way China can invade Taiwan with the American Navy, even with all the missiles China has and their so-called ship-killing missiles. No, our offensive capabilities are a hell of a lot stronger than theirs. We can defend Taiwan if we want to. The issue is, I don't believe Biden is going to defend Taiwan. I think Taiwan's going to be on their own. But I think that China would be making a mistake if they think that it is a foregone conclusion that in a war with Taiwan that China comes out on top. The real question is, what should we do with our relationship with China, knowing what we know about Wuhan, about COVID-19, knowing what we know about all these different things, about their long-term strategies? And incidentally, they are researching they're trying to gain of function research mm-hmm. with Ebola,
yeah,
which has about a 90% kill rate. And they're trying to develop bioweapons that target specific ethnicities. Imagine a China that could target every ethnicity that is not Chinese, and they could release a bioweapon with a 90% kill rate wow. upon the rest of the world. You know, if you want to know what I would do if I were if I were in a position to do it, I would have started a hot war with China as soon as we knew COVID-19 came from Wuhan. It was, the smoking gun was China shutting off travel between Wuhan and the rest of China, and not between China and the rest of the world. We should have started bombing their ports. Destroyed their navy at sea, all those artificial reefs they turned into stationary aircraft carriers. We should have destroyed those. Now, that was an act of war. It was a weapon of mass destruction. And you know, we didn't know that, unfortunately, until we had a regime change here. But we are in a war. Mm-hmm, and yeah. I think we need to react accordingly.
So you think that had we known all that, then that there should have been a response from the United States, your suggestion with this bioweapon and calling it an act of war is what you're saying, huh?
I would have destroyed their ports and I would have kept their ports. But what I really think we need to do is we need to recognize the government of Taiwan is the legitimate government of all of China. We've always had a one China policy. We've never said which government we recognize. I would come right out and say, guys, in Beijing, it's not you. We are recognizing the government of Taiwan as the legitimate government of Taiwan. We'll do everything that we can to put them in power over Beijing. Let China chew on that for a while. Wow. At the end of the day, we're still more powerful than they are. They may have one rocket they can fire at us that we can't shoot down. But right now, we seem to have control over that supersonic missile. So the time to strike is when you can still win. If we wait too long, there is a war coming with China. If we wait too long, first of all, it's going to be biological more than kinetic. And in biological, I think maybe they win. We've got the advantage right now for a kinetic war. I say we've been hit. We should hit back. And we should hit back in such a way as to cause a regime change. I don't want to destroy China. I just want to get rid of the regime in Beijing.
Pick up where Wallace talks there. That he really puts it out there very interesting with the ethnicities, with the bioweapons and these potential viruses that could be targeted. Very, very interesting. What do you think about that?
Oh, I really agree with Wallace said to help Taiwan become the legal country and only one China, so it can be Taiwan, because PRC China actually, from what they behave, it really is not a, it's really not a legal country. And also the reason PRC China can went into UN at that time is because they take the advantage. And then there was a statement, number is 2758 in the UN at that time. Actually, they play on the word and to chase Taiwan out. However, there is a lot of weakness in that statement. So now this time changed, this kind of problem can be fixed. And the way you fix it is to bring Taiwan back into UN and to kick China out, PRC China out. And if you still treat Chinese government as a legal country, then you give him a lot of power to do a lot of things in the future. And that's what China government really want. And also, I want to say that, Taiwan is very important. However, Chinese government also know they want Taiwan not only by using, militaries. And they have done for many, many years, as they have done to America, they have infiltrated Taiwan. So because they are all the Chinese people, so it's easier for them to manipulate using the Chinese culture and other things. So this is something America should be very care about. And also I want to remind Taiwan people to realize that Chinese government use good at this kind of soft way to take over the whole influence and also take over the power from your government. So this is something you must open your eyes and to always remind to get fight against the communist Marxism ideology.
And we are definitely doing that, fighting against an ideology that many people here do not recognize, for sure. And it's within our own government as well. Absolutely. Very interesting discussion, which I really appreciate in regards to even Taiwan and being proactive, playing offense rather than defense all the time, is another point of interest. This takes, big minds and big ideas, big thoughts. And the problem is our government is so disconnected right now and internally here that it's hard to imagine that they would get anything right at this point, sadly, friends. It is absolutely a wild card in all of this and all the stories we talked about. China is the wild card right now. And we haven't done a good job, as Wallace pointed out, since Nixon. So if we don't start to do a better job in the immediate future, well, all bets are off, my friends. We see the danger. The writing is on the wall, as they say, and it's right in front of us here. A tremendous thank you to Dr. Lee Meng-Yong here and Wallace Garneau, J.D. Rucker up top front of the program here with the top stories. There's so much happening in the news here. Very curious to see what will happen this week with the Rittenhouse trial, as we talked about here. It's fascinating as hell. And the January 6th commission and all of that. So we'll keep you posted and be on top of this back at America Out Loud. We'll see you back there, my friends, on the site there. And thank you for being on the mission here. It's time to get involved and get loud.